Hey, welcome to the Mentally Chill podcast brought to you from the East Coast. I'm here. I made it. I'm your host, Kristen Carney. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I moved to the East Coast temporarily at my parents'. I can't put enough exclamation points around the word temporarily. It's temporary. I'm saying that for me, not you. I'm trying to not feel bad about the situation I'm in right now. And I won't feel bad. I'm okay. I'll be fine. I won't be here long. I'm at my parents' and it's very pleasant. It's very comforting. I feel really great about being around things that are familiar and that feel like home. And I've had a couple bad days, big surprise. But I was so glad that I had them here on the East Coast rather than alone in my apartment in LA. The anxiety was still there, but it's like, okay, you suddenly have diarrhea. You're grateful if you have it at home or somewhere where there's a private toilet. So having anxiety at home felt like getting to do diarrhea in your house and not in a public restroom or at a party at a friend's house. That is probably one of the best analogies I will ever give. So you're welcome for that. But anyway, so today's episode, I have ex-NBA player Paul Shirley on the show talking to me about sports and how he used sports and basketball as therapy as a child and how it still helps him today and how he had to be a little OCD and a little crazy to get to the professional level of basketball. And we also talk about dating and depression, because he's a guy who's dating, and you can hear him talk about his dating on his podcast called Stories I Tell on Dates, and it's a highly produced podcast, much more highly produced than this one. Oh, and a quick side note about the show today. If you feel like listening to the show outside, I would recommend doing so, or if you feel like you need a nice summer night outside, you can get that by listening to today's episode, because we taped outside, and there's a grasshopper or a cricket or whatever, I don't know the difference, chirping in the background. It's a streaming sound. So eventually it'll fade away in your brain and you'll just enjoy listening to the wonderful conversation we're having and forget about the screaming cricket in the back. The problem is doing this podcast in such a grassroots way is that I don't know what my recording setup is going to be from show to show. So when I recorded with Paul, the space we were in, I was going to where he runs a writer's workshop and it was pure echo. And so we had an outside option. So we chose the outside option because the echo was so extreme. It was like either crickets or echo. So I picked the cricket route. So anyway, that's a little disclaimer. And of course, a quick shout out to all the new cult members on Patreon. That includes Anastasia, Marshall, John, and June. John rejoined. Thanks for rejoining, John. I'm glad that your brain got back on track where it should be. So I hope you guys enjoy this week's episode. If you want to support the show, please go to patreon.com/mentallychill. And you can always hit me up on Instagram at Chris Carn or on Twitter at Kristen Carney. I haven't been as active on either platforms over the past couple weeks because I'm trying to take a little mental break. But I still see messages, etc. So if you write to me, I will see them. And anyway, that's it for the introduction and enjoy the show.
So as a kid, I always read a lot and it was pretty much a nerd. Like I was into spelling bees and math contests and stuff like that. And I would always take this abuse for it. And I thought, well, by the time I'm 40, which is how old I am now, it'll just be me sitting around talking about like current events in Sierra Leone and like all kinds of interesting things. And it's not. People make fun of you for reading.
I'm one of those people.
That reads or makes fun of people?
Makes fun of people for reading. Man, it's but it's out of jealousy. I know. Well, like, you were hoping for intellects. You should go hang out on a college campus.
Well, yeah, today I think that would be worse. Like, it would just be people screaming at each other.
That's true.
Because I think we
but
don't...
But intelligently, at least,
maybe,
hopefully.
Yeah, it's just been shocking to me how, like, we don't have a lot of, like, deep conversations anymore. I feel like I had deeper conversations when I was, like, 18.
Yeah, well, I think when you're 18, you're expecting a lot out of life, and then right. You're shooting higher for higher conversations. And once we get here, 35, yeah. 40.
But don't you think don't you think like Paris in the 20s they were having deep like in ancient Greece they're like getting into stuff? Or is that just all that survived and so that's what we think that was
going on? That we fantasize and romanticize other eras, which I do. I'm obsessed with other eras. Mm-hmm. So when you close your eyes and picture it, yes, they were, but mm-hmm. I think the reality is everyone's pretty just basic.
Just trying to get through the day and either watch some football or some pre-early Olympics.
Well, I consider myself an old soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's part of me that is very much open to having, you know, bigger conversations and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. But I do have some people that I know, family and otherwise, mm-hmm. that are constantly trying to always have deep conversations. And it is exhausting because you really sometimes you want to hang around somebody and not feel the pressure of like, oh, geez, here we go. Now I got to worry about if I read enough in history to talk to this person. And blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, well, not sometimes. I think it's good to have a balance between the two.
Right.
And I have people say to me a lot, I feel like I can talk to you. I can like, we can talk about things.
Right.
But on the other hand of things, I think I'm also, I can be shallow and snarky. And so I go both ways. Mm. Which I think is important because if you're just walking down the street with your friend, you want to be able to kind of shoot the shit
right.
without getting into existential stuff. I think there's a time and place for everything.
Yeah, I think it's important, though, to be able to like dissect something, even if it's like surface level. Like, let's talk about like really what's going on.
Yeah, no.
No?
Sometimes.
Well, like, I'm trying to think of an example. Like... Well, I get approached to talk about sports a lot, and I don't care about sports. But I'm willing to talk about,
you
like...
You confuse people.
Yeah, I'm willing to talk about, like, why. Like, why is this interesting? Or, like, why are we talking about this? That's kind of interesting, I think. Or, like, if... I mean, what's the most obvious sort of shallow topic of conversation is probably, like, Kim Kardashian or something, right? But it's kind of interesting to talk about Kim Kardashian in the context of, like... royalty, maybe.
Oh,
like,
totally. I'd go in depth on Kim.
So I can go deep into that. I just don't want to talk about like the actual surface level stuff. I can talk about surface level things, but in like...
So you mean surface level as in minutia of like, how's the weather? That kind of thing? Is like, it that like that basic of
well,
a conversation?
I think like, so even talking about the weather, I think because it's been hot in LA, that gets me thinking about like, why do people talk about the weather, right? Like it obviously gives us something that like sort of is a commonality, but I also think it's important to have something that we all unite against. The weather is a great like other that it gives you something to like be like, oh, we all hate this together.
Right.
And that's bonding.
I think
like you grew up in upstate New York, right? Like you have winter to deal with. I grew up in Kansas, same kind of thing. You're like,
it's
cold out there.
I love bonding over shared hatreds.
Yeah.
I really like, feel like it unites people more than shared loves.
Oh, for sure. This is why I hate when people are like, well, I don't like to complain. And you're like, well, what are we going to talk about? This, what people do is they complain about things. You can get into a cycle of complaining too much. But in general, like you and I, when we walked in tonight, I was like, wow, tough day at the thingamajig. If I had just been like, everything's great, then you don't have anything to latch onto. You're like, what?
Exactly.
I don't know how to talk to you.
Right. That's how you become a human being. I do another podcast, which you were on a while ago, about dating.
Mm-hmm. And the Ask Women podcast.
Yeah, right? Yeah, good memory. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this like banter guide for guys. And in the banter guide, I said I would roughly stay around being like 60% positive, 40% negative on things.
Right.
Because if you're 100% positive, it's like it's like too much sugar.
Right.
It's like sickening.
Right.
But then obviously you don't want to be too much negative because that's also sickening.
Yeah.
It's like too much salt.
Right.
So you want to find a balance. But anyone that's constantly happy, there's something wrong. There's something going on. Or they're totally empty and they really have nothing to offer. I joke that I'm shallow, but there's a lot going on in here.
Right, right.
But so you use sports as a way to help yourself through a depression.
Yeah. Well, I think when I was a 12-year-old, I went through this like stupid in retrospect, but at the time it seemed very vital existential crisis where I was like, whoa, growing up doesn't sound awesome. Like all these people don't seem happier than I am. Like I'm pretty happy as a kid and all these grown-ups seem kind of sad. And I remember just being like stuck in this rut of like, this is going to suck. And then from there, it was just, I think that was like, it was almost like Skynet turned on. And that's when I kind of started overthinking things. Before that, I was just like a kid.
Skynet. What was Skynet?
That's the Terminator, like the thing in Terminator that like takes over the world.
Oh,
right?
Damn. I've never seen
like
a Terminator.
Like the sort of like singularity happens, you know, where like my brain was just like, all right, that's fun time is over. Now it's time to overthink things. And I think that sort of persisted into middle school where I was like a super late bloomer and all the other kids were like getting mature. And I was like, I don't really even care about girls. And all my friends are like starting to like snap girls' bras.
They're like, check
and stuff.
Out this boner.
Right. And
they're like, it's almost as tall as Paul. That's a huge boner.
That's a big boner. So yeah, I think like, that was kind of like the entree into anxiety. And then, from there, I found that, like my dad was pretty hard on us and that basketball, when I would go outside, I would just be outside shooting baskets and everything felt okay.
Yeah.
It was a lot like I compare it a lot to, for if you hear us giggling, that's because the lights
went out,
turned out.
And I'm trying desperately to be smooth with the flashlight on my phone.
Trying to get her phone to be dead.
Oh, there we go. There we go. That's what I was looking for.
It's moody.
For everyone listening, I shined the light up against a bright wall, and so it's shining back at us rather than just...
We've got some plants that are being well lit from the back.
Yeah.
And so I found that, I think in the same way, I actually compare athletes to musicians a lot, in that I think we understand that musicians are kind of like angsty, and so that's why they found music. A lot of athletes, the like smarter ones who are not just like, I'm Mike Trout and I hit home runs, probably found it as a way to like combat some sort of feeling a little odd or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true for me. I loved the feeling of peace that I got from being on the basketball court. It also allowed me, when I was like playing games, to put aside the like reasonable, studious kid I was and just lose my shit.
And just slam dunks.
Right, right.
Never, I was going to say slam dunks, but slam dunks. Yeah.
Yeah, slam some dunks. so just like, I think behave in that bestial way that is not encouraged by the world, and which was like inside of me, but I didn't feel how I could connect that to the outside world.
Right.
The right way.
My problem with, not my problem with sports, but here's my beef with sports. As a kid, I didn't fit in school and I was picked on, and I tried desperately to do the sports stuff because it was like, that's what you do.
Right.
I'm from a small town, and so everyone joined the softball league, you know, the mini, whatever it was called when you were little, and then everyone did the soccer and everyone did. Mm-hmm. And so it felt so wrong for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you are who you are from the get-go.
Right.
And I hate group activities and I hate groups of people. And I would be like 8 years old being like, oh, I got to go with a freaking group of people. Look at all these idiots. I gotta try to fit in with all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually wasn't terribly unathletic. I choked a lot. I choked now. I choked. And I'm not being gross. I just, you know, when something's right there, I always fuck up. And I've been doing that since I was a kid. So I wasn't the worst athletically, but I also would just choke. If the goal was right there, I'd find some way to screw it up.
Mm.
But I found that the kids, and I'm extra bitter, but I found the kids that played sports that were girls to be awful human beings. And so I'm not anti-sports. I'm not like this, like, you know, fuck football and like it's so stupid, because I actually am a huge football fan. I love the Buffalo Bills. I'm a diehard Bills fan. But when it comes to kids and sports, I have such a bad taste in my mouth, because the coaches were the parents that were the cool parents in town, and my parents weren't the cool parents, and so I was benched even though I wasn't the worst player.
Right, right.
And so I became extra bitter against sports.
Well, yeah, I think it sports are problematic in that it does kind of encourage that bestial behavior that I was talking about. When you multiply it times hormones and peer pressure, it can lead to like people acting like dicks, right? Especially when they're 17 or 18 or 19 years old.
Or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 right, or 10 right. or 11 or 12.
And I think like we also, I don't know if this is an American thing exactly, but like we tend to emphasize team sports, which could be construed as good, but we don't talk a lot about like tennis or golf or things where you could just express this muscle without having to be in a group, right? Like we don't train that.
Have you ever seen the movie Grease?
Sure.
Okay, great. Sometimes people haven't seen Grease and I go, "What are you talking? You haven't seen Grease? Oh my God." But Danny Zuko, John Travolta, wants to show off for Sandy, and so he like goes out for sports teams and they're like, "How about an individual sport?" Because he was just like punching guys in the face. Yeah. And so he ended up doing track. And I mean, I don't think he stuck with it.
So maybe you should have done track is what you're saying. I
did end up doing track, but I hated it. Because then the pressure that I felt when the gun went off and all of a sudden I'm racing against some assholes that I didn't want to be on a team with in the first place. And I'm like, oh my God.
There's no winning.
There's no winning. And actually one time, one of my worst memories of sports was when I was on track and I had a crush on this guy who was like a senior. And I think I was like, I was a freshman or a sophomore or something. And he came to watch me and I was so nervous.
Right.
And I was running the 400 meter.
That's the worst race.
Oh my God. And I was trying so hard to win and to go as fast as I could. My legs turned to actual jelly and I fell and tripped and he watched me just fall on my face. And just, it was the worst. I thought I was going to use that
he
as
He probably
my
thought
mojo.
It was adorable. That's the thing. Like it's interesting thinking about yourself at that time because you're like, I've blown this. But he probably was like, oh my God, Kristen's so cute. She like tried real hard and fell down.
Well, he's written me like maybe one or two Facebook messages since 20 years ago. So totally. I'm on his radar still when he's unhappy in his marriage.
Right.
But I wish that I could have used sports in that sense to help me mentally. What I ended up using was dance, which is very similar. It's a group thing as well.
Yeah,
but
it's also like I think one of the great things about basketball, which I don't play basketball, I don't watch basketball anymore, but one of the things I loved about it was that it is an expression of your body in the same way that dance is. Like I think people that gets lost. Basketball in particular is so abstract. And like there's no telling what's going to happen from 1 minute to the next, unlike football or baseball, which are usually like you go here and then you go there and those are the only options. And so like I'm not a good dancer, but I have noticed that like I feel really good when I am using my body in a particular way. And I trained it for so long to be really effective that it is sort of intoxicating to know like I'm good at this thing. And I can do it better than anybody else, right? And I think that's kind of how dance can feel, right?
Definitely. It's like there's a high to it. Like when you're at the peak of what you're doing and you feel good about it, the high feels so amazing. And so I bet that's what it's like for basketball. So how long were you using basketball, you think, therapeutically?
I think I poured basically everything into basketball from the time I was 14 or 15 to 30.
What age were you when you sprouted up and got really tall?
I didn't ever have the stereotypical growth spurt, which worked in my favor. So I was like, you know, just a tall-ish kid and then a taller-ish kid. And then when I was 14, I had my first driver's license.
What? You get what?
Well, in Kansas, you know, we're rednecks.
14, you can drive?
Yeah, you get it. Well, it's a learner's permit, but first driver's license, I was 5'11 and I weighed 120 pounds.
Oh my God.
Which is like, if you're a supermodel, that's a great size.
Right.
For a 14-year-old boy, that's neither tall nor big.
Yeah.
It's just like it's wispy and most of my friends were that same like height, but they weighed 170 pounds or something. So then I just like kept kind of growing and growing and growing. And then throughout just, I've been thinking a lot about, because a lot of people now who know me, because I do all this writing stuff and all that, they know me to be tall, but they don't know that I played basketball, right? And so when they find out, they'll be like, oh, well, did you just play basketball because you're tall? Which is a common refrain, right? But as I look back at my life and career, like I could tell from a pretty early age, like I just get this so much better than everybody else does. And if you really just bored into my brain, I would tell you I would have played in the NBA even if I'd been 6'2". Now, that's probably not true, but I don't know that it's not the case. Like basketball just made so much more sense to me than anything else except for reading and like academics that like it is interesting because people just assume like, well, he's 6'9", so that's why he played basketball. But I just got lucky and turned out to be 6'9". I loved basketball. I loved everything about it and I loved being really good at it. So it almost is an insult to me when people assume that. They don't mean it to be an insult, but because of the way that I see it, I'm like, no, this was like, I was going to do it either which way.
Yeah.
I also think we don't give kids enough credit for recognizing when they're good at something. Like, because I could tell I was a really great baseball player, but I wasn't quite as good at baseball as I was at basketball. I was like, well, I'm going to fucking concentrate on this thing that I'm really good at, much like you probably did with dance, where you're like, I can tell I'm good at this thing. The other tough thing, and this kind of goes back to the mental health aspect, actually, is that I don't think you can be completely stable and do something to the degree that I did it. Like, I think there was a level of instability and OCD that allowed me to get really good. It really was a curse at times. Like, there were times where I was driving myself almost in a literal sense insane because I was so obsessed with, like, perfection and doing things right, which drove me to be really good, but also didn't make me happy. Because what people think about basketball is that it's like when they played high school basketball, and it's just an extension of that. And they're like, well, that was awesome. We practiced 2 days, or, you know, 2 hours a day, and then we played a game on Friday nights, and everybody cheered for us. And you're like, that's not how it works. Like, when you get to these next levels, the competition is extreme. You're playing in front of thousands of people. There's money on the line. And in order to get to that level, you need to be a crazy person. And I was a crazy person. I didn't drink till I was 27, which is nuts in and of itself.
Yeah.
I didn't date, really. Like, that's the stories I tell on dates, this podcast that I'm kind of talking about. A big part of it is, like, I woke up at some point and realized, like, I hadn't had a girlfriend, really. Like, I didn't have a true girlfriend until I was 30 years old.
You realize that, and then you're like, oh, and I need a drink now.
Yeah.
Now I'm seeing women. Oh, dear God. Give me a drink, somebody.
Right. And I think, like, that's the underside that when I talk about those things, especially, like, back home, people are like, oh, you're just making that up. And I'm like, why would I make that up? I was kind of sad a lot.
Right.
I'm not saying this is good. It's just the way it was. You know?
You were sad a lot because of the torture you were putting yourself through?
Yeah, just because I couldn't really live up to the expectation that I had set for myself. So I played out of fear of failure as opposed to, for a long time. And then I had this major event happen where I kind of switched. I almost died while playing for the Chicago Bulls.
What?
Yeah, I had my kidney and spleen ruptured in the game.
Oh, jeez.
And on the plane ride back from Indianapolis, where we were playing, to Chicago, they didn't know that this had happened. They thought they were suspicious, but we just kind of maybe thought I had broken a rib or something. And on this plane, I was bleeding internally into the retroperitoneal cavity on the left side of my body. And I was screaming and crying and feeling a pain like no one will ever
feel.
What
a baby.
Like, yeah, what a sissy. That's actually what I was thinking at the time, was like, because I'd been on the Bulls for like 7 days of a 10-day contract. And I was like, I'm never going to live this down if it's just a cracked
rib. Of
course,
right.
Like, I'm just like shrieking, but also like, right, this is going to be embarrassing.
You're trying to keep the face.
Yeah. I'm just like, don't be a pussy. Like, keep it together. And that had all happened because we were down 30, but I was on this 10-day contract and I knew I had to do everything right to stick around. And I'd played like 27 minutes in this game, which is still my career high in the NBA. And so I had rotated over in this game to try to take a charge, which is when the offending player like runs into you, you know, and you fall down. But I got there late and
I stuck
my... Is
that like the overacting, the fall down part?
Yeah, when you fall down.
Yeah.
I got there late and I raised my arms and lifted my rib cage, and that's his knee hit my side just inadvertently. And then my kidney and spleen hit my backbone and exploded. Right. And afterward, like when I was on the plane, the trainer who had been a trainer for the San Francisco 49ers, it turns out was terrified that I was going to bleed out on the plane, but he didn't want to tell me that. He didn't want to say like, by the way, you might be about to die. But I remember it was so
ignorance
painful.
Ignorance is bliss. I'd rather just go and not know.
Right. It was so painful that not only would I have been fine not knowing, but like I actively had the thought of like, I'd be fine with dying now.
That's
which
how
actually
painful it was.
Gives you a lot of hope for when you're old, because you will get to that point where you're just like, fuck
I'm okay.
It.
I'm, right.
This is, I've had enough.
I'm there already and I'm not old.
This is not for your move.
Well, I was saying on another podcast that if a plane goes down, right, you know, I'm just like, you know, if it happens, it happens. And it's been interesting.
That's actually the response I have, largely because of this thing that happened. When I'm on a plane now and it gets turbulent, it's been a good run.
Right. At least I'm not bleeding out.
Yeah, let's go. And so because of that, I had this like real change of heart in the way that I looked at life, but also sports. And I actually got way better because I stopped being so, before that I clung to things so tightly. And I think it was a reaction or like a kind of a control thing, mm-hmm. like where I just felt like if I can control every variable in this very tight way, then I can manage the outcomes. When I let go of some of that and just sort of like let the wheel go a little bit, I was so much better, so much happier. I had to work less hard. And it was a pretty amazing life lesson. I remember in driver's ed, they would always show us that, you know, with a car, with a steering wheel, if you crank it all the way to the one way or the other, the car actually can't turn. You have to like kind of let it back a little bit. And that's kind of how I feel about things.
I just mentioned being okay with the plane going down.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I got to that point was because I was doing what you were doing on a smaller scale, but I was trying to control the flight because I was so afraid of flying that I would be so tight and so I would control everything. I would checking out the plane before I got on it to like my own. I had all of these rituals and it was like the more I controlled those rituals, the safer I was going to be.
Right.
And in my mind, if I stopped worrying,
mm-hmm.
that's the minute the plane would go down.
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually fight with that even now when it comes to things like I get really paranoid about getting sick. Because I think for a long time, if I got sick, it basically was the ruin of my career, right? Like, you don't play, you don't get paid.
If I get sick, it does wonders for my career. I'm like, guys, I have more problems to worry about. Here, I'll talk about
Let's
it on my
talk
podcast.
About those. And I will find myself like, well, if I stopped worrying about that, then it's just going to happen. Which is classic, like, catastrophizing.
And, yes. Yeah. The minute I stopped freaking out on the plane, it was really honestly like mind-blowing because nothing else changed. You know, none of my planes have gone down and nothing terrible has happened since I've let a lot of the control go. And it's good because now in other parts of my life, I kind of realize it's like I've got just like I can feel just like my butt cheeks clenched so tight. You know, everything's just like, ah.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I try to just be a little bit more lackadaisical. I'm trying not to control so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so not everything else will go down.
I cannot crash
too.
This plane. I tried to crash this plane, but I couldn't.
Well, when I was 12, it was funny because you just referenced being 12. I remember being 12 and getting on a plane for the first time since I was like six. The first time I'd flown, I was six. Then I had a long six. It was a slow 6 years between six and 12. Not much traveling.
That's better. I was like 14 the first time I got on a plane, period. So you're ahead of me.
Well, Kentucky.
Kansas,
God damn it.
They're not the same.
Two Ks, you just need a third K. It'd be a complete triple. I don't know. But I was on the plane for the first time since I was six. And I remember when I was six, I thought it was the coolest. And it was so exciting. And then when I was 12, I started to realize life doesn't last forever. And I got really freaked out.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was on the flight, I would not move because I thought if I moved at all, if I picked up a spoon from my tray, I would throw off the plane. And if I moved my foot, I would throw off the plane. So I just sat there frozen for the whole flight and then obviously realized that was ridiculous. But
do you think is that just an impossible to solve nature versus nurture thing? Because some of it has to do with intelligence, right?
I think I just wasn't very smart.
No, I think you're too smart.
No, but I wasn't smart enough to realize that.
You're thinking like because you're already aware of like causality that other people are just like, I'm not going to think about
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also, it's like being too smart, but for some reason not having the coping mechanisms. Like, because I think that's, and I don't know what that is, parents or just how you're wired or what it is.
Well, it's definitely part parent. Well, parents and wiring. My mom is a nervous wreck constantly. I mean, talk about a tight butt. I mean, her butt is just,
yeah.
She should have of glutes of steel because she's always just constantly
yeah.
But so she was afraid of flying and I definitely picked up that energy.
Right.
But the other part to it, I think, is giving myself too much credit. Like I gave myself too much credit. I affect this plane,
and
I still kind of would do that until semi-recently, but you know, my worry affects this plane and keeps the plane afloat. But I have to remember that I'm a speck of dust.
Yeah. So it's basically just like an ego issue in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like I am that important that this whole thing is going to come apart.
Yes.
If I don't. Yeah. I think that's one thing you've been hard on Kansas and I'm going to let that slide. But like if I'm back home, and you just get kind of in the open, it reminds you really quickly of how meaningless you are. And I think in a city, it's really easy to like start to think you're much more important than you are, which is one thing I don't love about LA.
Right. Well, it's weird because you would think it would maybe do the opposite in a city because there's so many of us that we would go, oh, look how many of me there are. Mm-hmm. But it's because we're all on this pile and heap of each other, just trying to climb to the top like ants or animals.
Yeah.
But so you don't struggle with depression now or
not really. I think, yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of therapy. That helps.
Are you still in therapy?
Yeah. I go once a month now. And I did like...
When someone's not depressed and they still go to therapy, I'm like, you're just wasting your money. This is when they take advantage of not
crazy.
Being depressed.
What do you mean? That's like, it's like just because you're working out doesn't mean you're out of shape, right? Like you got to maintain those muscles.
Right. But this is me being a lazy piece of shit and going, okay, well, here's the moment. You give yourself a freaking break and so then you and like, then you wait for it to get terrible and
so
then you,
like, you
go again.
Work out till you hit a plateau and you're like, all right, I'm good for like 6 months.
Definitely. It's like when you pedal on your bike and you get the wheel going so fast, then you can just start coasting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be me. If I was out of depression, oh my God, I wouldn't see a therapist forever. Because I'm coasting now.
Well, I think like, I don't know. I think everybody should go to therapy, of course. As just a way to like, cause like it depends on what stage of your life. Right now I'm in a pretty like, I don't know, productive time of writing books and running this workshop and I'm very busy. And so mostly I go to therapy to kind of like talk about prioritizing and like just checking in, making sure we're okay. But
I go to have a friend to have coffee with. Laugh at my jokes.
Somebody to just listen. I think like, yeah, for me, a lot of therapy started right after I stopped playing. Because it's weird to retire from something when you're 32,
right?
And you cannot do it again. It's not like, if you're a hedge fund manager,
and I'm not,
and you like hit it big, then you might stop at 32 because you're like, well, I've done enough of that. But you could always go back to it. Basketball, you're done. Like that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so smart. You know, I'm not. Backtracking on what I was saying, I was kidding about the therapy stuff, but I think it's so smart that when you stop doing the thing you're great at, mm-hmm. to start seeing a therapist right away.
Oh yeah, I did like a year of twice a week.
Wow.
Because I could, like, people had told me, like, you're going to be depressed when this is over.
They must have had a pretty long couch in there.
Hey-o! Late night jokes.
I can't help it. I'm sorry.
And it was like, yeah, it was the thing that I took away from it. I guess this is the appropriate time to talk about this, is that because of basketball, like I had trained myself to show no emotion, because on the court, you cannot show any weakness, right? And you don't want to like let the crowd know you're nervous, because that might tee off your opponent to know that you're nervous.
Right.
Like, nobody needs to know that you're nervous, but you're shooting a free throw in front of 15,000 people.
Oh,
and there's a million people watching
my,
on TV.
Oh,
and so
God.
your heart's racing at 120 beats per minute. And you're like, this whole season comes down to this, and I gotta not screw this up, right? But you gotta pretend that that's not what's going on. And so there were times when I would sit there and be in therapy, and she'd be like, I can't tell if you're feeling anything. So like, it was
your free throw moment.
Yeah, it was an interesting, like, I was like, oh, well, I'm trying, but I just couldn't do it because I had trained myself for so long.
Well, when
to
I watched,
not do that.
You know, because I watch football, if someone's kicking an extra point, or I mean, I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, and there's the famous Super Bowl loss where...
Yeah, who's the kicker?
Scott Norwood.
Scott Norwood. I saw that recently. I saw it was a Scott Norwood jersey where they had put the number and the name all the way off to the right on the jersey.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which is fucking hilarious.
That's really funny. And I feel like some letters should be missing because it couldn't get in there. But, you know, the composure to go out there and it's like, you know, the third Super Bowl they've been to. Mm-hmm. This is the one. All they need is this goal. And then you just fuck it up.
Yeah.
He's a salesman now or something, which is so perfect.
Yeah.
It's like, of course, he'd either become a salesman or a murderer.
Right.
And I'm glad he picked
himself.
The first. Yeah. So, right. And so when I see athletes doing these things in front of so many people, I'm watching them going, oh my God, don't become a salesman. So did you get pretty depressed though after you finished playing? Because I know for me, I never obviously was like professionally dancing, but when I was done as a dancer, I've been, I think, deeply depressed since. I really have been. And I just haven't done much about it.
That's the high point, was the dance.
It was. I loved it so much. But I have seriously been, I think, super sad ever since. Did you find happiness again after you stopped playing?
It took a while, but I think it was a matter of, like, I think I was lucky because I'd had that terrible thing happen during my career, and that had, like, kind of tipped me off that I needed to, like, take a little better care of myself mentally. But with that said, it did take a while to, like, connect to, I'm okay without this thing. Because in reality, really getting down to it, I think I also used basketball as a way to just prop up my self-esteem. Like, I'm good at this thing, therefore people will like me, girls will like me, whatever it is. I don't have to, like, have a personality. I can just rely on, like, I'm good at basketball.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of being a really hot girl,
yeah,
is being good at basketball.
Same, yeah, or being in a rock band or whatever it is. You know, like, you just are like, well, I think, and a lot of that was because I just didn't understand. It kind of goes back to that late blooming thing. Like, I was just, like, so far behind that I just didn't understand what other people were doing. So I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go get really good at sports, and then they have to like me. It was really not that healthy, but it was so true. I
mean, right, right.
Exactly what I did.
Do you think part of your desire for the perfectionism came from your pressure from your father?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Yeah.
My dad. Like, the classic story is that the first time I ever scored 30 points in a high school basketball game, which I was like, whoa.
That's a lot.
That seemed like a lot. And I remember I came home and he's like, don't get ahead of yourself. You should have had 40.
Wow.
Which is, like, how you train a professional athlete.
It is. But that's also how you fuck somebody up.
Right. Which is not, it's just, it's not a great way to, like, be a parent.
Are most athletic people's, or I guess you, instead of saying athletic people, I could say athletes.
Yeah.
Are most athletes' fathers nightmares? Like, are they all like that? Not that I'm saying your dad's a nightmare,
yeah,
but,
well, I think,
are they all that hard on their kids?
It's tough for me to say, because a lot of the guys that I was around probably came from single parent homes where it was just their mom.
Right. That's true.
So I don't,
okay,
I mean, I think that was, but that's, like, a different thing, which is also unhealthy.
Right.
Right. And I think, like, it just, that's the thing that that's so hard to know is, like, I'm grateful that I got to play basketball for as long as I did. And I got to have these amazing experiences, and I have so many things to talk about. I wouldn't have had those if my dad wasn't pretty hard on me, but I would also be probably better adjusted, or I would have been a better adjusted at an early age. So I don't know what the answer is. Like, am I thankful for that or am I not? I really don't know.
Are you in a good relationship with your father?
Not great.
Like, are you guys dating? The way I just phrased that was weird.
I was home recently, and my brothers and I are always, because there's four of us, I'm, like, the least favorite, even though I played professional basketball and, like, went to college on a national merit scholarship and have written two books.
Right.
And I'm like,
it's ridiculous.
That one. Because I think my dad just cannot understand me. He just does not grasp my life.
Well, you do have, you were talking about how you like to have deeper conversations.
Yeah.
And I sense that about you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it does throw people off when you're an athlete, but you look like you want to get into more stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Conversation-wise. So is that where you're disconnecting with your dad? Is your dad kind of straight-up sports guy?
Yeah, well, he's his own little dichotomy. He's got a PhD in child psychology. Did not play a lot of sports, but I think really responded to us playing sports. Coached us a lot, like, really got into that side of it. And I think it is true that, like, since I stopped playing basketball, he has less to talk to me about. Like, we had a lot to talk about when it was, like, my career and, like, well, are you going to play in Poland or America or Spain next year? You know, like, that gave us something to talk about. And he doesn't really want to talk to me about my writing or, like, like writer's block or these things that I'm doing. And so that just doesn't connect.
Yeah.
But he's not, like, your stereotypical burly man with
right.
a goatee who only wears, like, University of Kansas gear.
Right, right.
He's kind of an intellectual, but...
That's interesting, just
yeah.
because you have that vibe, the intellectual vibe, and so mm-hmm. I'm surprised that you guys don't connect on that level.
Yeah, I don't...
But does that make you... I'm not trying to bring up daddy issues or something like that and make you a stripper, but
right.
does that ever bother you that you're the least... favorite, because you're kind of laughing about it, but deep down you've got to be a little sad.
Yeah, I just don't know. I have a friend who, well, you actually know my friend Justin Halpern. We did the Short Corner podcast together, and he is famous for having written that Shit My Dad Says
oh, that
Twitter
was him?
Account. Yeah, And
I didn't realize that.
He's got this kind of amazing relationship with his dad where his dad will just call him. And I was in his office one time and his dad's like, oh, I heard you were kind of feeling bad. Just wanted to check in and make sure you're doing okay. And I was like, my dad has never done that.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad's called me like
who is this?
Five times in my life. It's always, I mean, if I, we, it's not like we've only talked five times, but if it's me calling him.
Right. My dad never calls me.
Really?
I love my dad so much. He's my favorite person in the world, basically. And mm-hmm. But, you know, he never calls. And then I'll send him a text. He won't respond. I'm like, hello.
Yeah, it's a weird generational thing where I think my dad is just like, I'm finished with them. Like, I did my best, and now they're gone. And, like, now I'm going to
So if
be
you
done.
Call, will yeah. he talk then?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's not like he's like, I'm not going to talk to you or something. It's just that it's a weird disconnect. And we actually speak on the phone fairly effectively. We just do not exist well in the same room.
Right. So when you're in therapy now, what are you talking about mostly? Because you haven't played basketball since you were 30, what?
Like 32. So it's been like 8 years since I stopped. Yeah.
So when you go to therapy, is it at all still focused on the basketball stuff?
No, it's more talking about, I talk a lot about how I'm an extreme people pleaser. My dad probably kind of a narcissist. And so I tend to go out of my way to make everybody else around me happy. And that can cause problems sometimes. Earlier you were like, I'll get your water. And it makes me uneasy. I'm like, ah, ah.
Well, see, I'm a people pleaser as well because I'm like, well, you're doing this nice thing. You're doing my podcast. I'm not going to make you get up and go get your water. I'd feel like such a dick.
Right. Yeah. We would be trouble. If we were to spend any time together,
yeah.
Like, well, I'll get that for you.
No, I think,
like, it's the funny thing is, like, the world would go round better if more people were sort of people pleasers. So I think it's healthy, and I always want to be giving and loving and those sorts of things, but I have to work on just, like, figuring out how to be okay with telling someone, like, I can't do that, or that I've done enough, or whatever it is, and it's tricky.
How does being a people pleaser affect your everyday life, the quality of it?
I think it just means that I worry too much about whether the thing I'm about to say is one of those things I hate when people say on dates, right? Where they're like, I am so much this way. And you're like, well, let me figure that out. Like you're front loading this information.
Well,
I would
always hate when I'd see on like a Bumble profile where it'd say, like fluent in sarcasm. No, why don't you just be
sarcastic? You're
not
fluent in sarcasm.
Right.
If you say that. Right.
It's so, yeah, I get it.
So, yeah, I just tend to hate when people are like, I'm this way. But I am just like hyper aware of how everyone's feeling in a room at all times, which is really great for basketball, actually, because you're just like always attuned to what's going on. You're just like constantly aware. And it's really great for running like this writer's workshop I run because I can always kind of tell, like, is this person okay or like whatever. It's also really good for public speaking because you're like, I'm here with you and I can see that person's not paying attention or that person, it's great for dating, right? Like you're always like, I can see she's not real happy right now or like whatever's going on.
Well, that's because there was a drink thrown in your face, right. But yes, you're great at reading cues.
But like it also can work against you because you're so hypersensitive that you then are like just eaten up by like, well, is that person mad at me? Why are they mad at me? Like I got to take care of this and that's not.
That's me constantly.
A way to live.
Yeah. Because of being, you know, a comic and who I am naturally, I never stop reading the room.
Right.
Ever.
Well, I bet for comedy, it's great, right?
Yeah. It works great in one sense, but in the other sense, it like ruins your life.
Right.
I mean, I can't enjoy anything.
Mm-hmm.
The last birthday party I had was when I turned 30. I'm 35 now. I will never have another birthday party. I could be told you have one more birthday and then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
I would still not have a party because I'm so worried about everybody at the party.
Yeah.
Are they comfortable? Are they having fun? Do they know each other? I don't have a group of friends. It's one-off people. So I'm introducing everyone, making sure they're okay,
mm-hmm.
making sure they're comfortable, watching this person get drunk. I want to explain that they're not always that drunk and, you know, and
right.
I'm always trying to do damage control. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, I mean, I can't even imagine like my best friend's getting married in November. That sounds bad enough as it is, but the actual day of the wedding, I would never be able to do it because I would be like, oh no, I think this person probably doesn't like the cake. We should probably go talk to them and make them, you know, give them something to make them happy. And then this person's definitely bored and that person looks like they're going to puke. And I would lose it. And so I feel the pain
mm-hmm.
and it's constant, but I don't know how to stop it or change it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I love about therapy is being able to have someone to bounce these things off of.
Do you think that you would be doing other things right now in terms of your career if you didn't have this personality type? I know for me, it's really put me back a million degrees because I'm afraid to ask favors. I'm afraid to put myself out there. So I think way too much about everything. And then I therefore stand in the wings because I don't want to bother people because of my overthinking. And then I struggle career-wise.
So do you...
And also I'm untalented, but don't worry about that part.
No, no, you're not. do you think that when you were dancing, I'm guessing you were not thinking as much, right? You're just sort of existing.
Right.
And so for me, it helps to sort of like invoke that basketball mentality, which is almost like acting because you're like, this is me, but it's not really me. Mm-hmm. And so I actually really do well with like just asking people for things because I'm like, I can get to that basketball mode of like, this isn't really me. I can put myself aside and I can put my concerns away and I'm just like, fuck it. Like, let's go. And like that has helped me a lot actually with dating to be able to just like go into this phase of like, this girl is probably going to shoot me down, but like she's cute and across this coffee shop from me and we made eye contact a few times. I'm walking over there. What's the worst that can happen? Right. Even though that's maybe at my core, not exactly who I am, but because of basketball, it like taught me that everything's going to be okay.
Have you ever dated a girl with depression? I'm asking that because I get a lot of people that write to me and say, could you do a show on dating with depression?
Yeah. I live in LA, Kristen. Shit.
Yeah.
I dated two girls in a row who both said the same thing to me verbatim, which was so weird. It's not like such a strange thing, but it was because I dated them right in a row and because they were very similar people. Huh. They both said, like late at night, like after we had been lying there just talking or something, they were like, I just feel dead inside. I'm like, what?
Well, I'm with the third girl to say it because I think I've been saying it all along tonight. So yeah. I'm sorry to add to that list.
No, it was, but I think like it was a combination of antidepressants and also like they had hit
you
and me. Yes. They're like, you're not giving me anything to live for.
If you were to meet a girl that you did really like, but she revealed maybe two dates in that she was severely depressed and working on it,
mm-hmm.
how would you feel about that?
I think like I would be more into that than someone who's completely vapid and because I think you have to be of a certain level of intelligence to be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that at least we're going to have something to talk about.
Right.
Like how can you not be somewhat depressed some of the time if you're not paying attention? And this has nothing to do with current events. I just mean like if you're just like aware of the amount of suffering that's just inherent to the world, you'd have to be a little bit depressed.
Oh,
you're a fucking psychopath.
Totally.
And so I think like, because I've been through some of that stuff, we've really gotten into some stuff tonight.
We
Kristen.
Have.
I'm about
you
to say
said you like to.
That, yeah, that
get into
I would
it.
Not have expected myself to say, but like, I think I like to show people things, like guide people. That's a very, like, a way that people behave in relationships. Like, men especially are prone to wanting to, like, show people things and teach people
I'm
things.
I'm trying so hard to not make a dick pic joke right now. Can you please stop saying show people things?
And teach people
just
things?
Don't say it, Kristen. Don't say it. Just say dick pic. Okay.
All right. We've
so
we've
you
want to
show
it.
Them.
So I like teaching people things, right? And that's like inherently we don't like that in society these days. I don't think, but it's a pretty traditional. Like,
they call
masculine,
that mansplaining now.
It's a pretty traditional like masculine role, whatever. And so I think like if somebody's like willing to be like, well, you've kind of been through this, like help me,
mm-hmm.
then I would want to do that.
So well, guys are fixers. Guys want to fix.
Yeah.
Girls want to just talk and be like, bleh. Even right. though obviously, eventually, yes, it, you know, it'd be nice
right.
if it was fixed.
Right.
So what you're saying is it wouldn't scare you away.
No, as long as the person's like wants to get better.
Right.
Right. But I also am like, and as we all are, right, like I'm way into personal improvement in general. So it wouldn't matter if it's depression or something else. Like I want people who are like a serious girlfriend and I once learned German together just so we could speak German to each other.
Well, that's a strange kink. What's your...
It doesn't always have to do with sex, Kristen.
Sorry.
It was more just like...
You're setting it up. I really am not...
We could just be in the grocery store and we could just like speak German and people are like, what
just
the
scare
fuck?
People? It's funny when someone chooses German, but I love the sound of German.
Yeah, man. It's great.
One of my favorite movies is Inglourious Bastards.
Yeah.
And obviously because Quentin Tarantino is amazing, but because I love the sound of German.
Yeah.
It's weird. Some people hate it. Where are your people from? I'm mostly Irish and Italian, but then I have a little English and a little German.
Yeah. We picked German because I speak pretty good Spanish, and so we didn't want it to be Spanish. And then French, too close to Spanish.
Too close to Spanish.
So German was like, well, it's fucking completely weird. Right. So anyway, I love that we did this thing together. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's like you had a child together, the most amazing child, and then you were like, Matt, peace out, and you just left the baby die.
It was a sad breakup.
Your German baby's dead.
But like I think anything to do with like, you know, if I had a girlfriend and she's like, we're only eating this for a long time just to see do we do better? I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's just interesting to like see how we can better ourselves.
Wow. Yeah. See, I get stubborn with that stuff. I'm like, no. Nothing's gonna change. I'm gonna still be miserable. Whatever. Like, can we just watch a movie? This work
I just
shit
be
improvement.
Sad
whatever.
In my bed.
Yeah. Okay. So how would a girl phrase it to you if you had gone on two dates and a big part of her life was struggling with her mental health or depression?
Right.
But she doesn't want to hide it from you.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's not something like you don't want to put them up like your boobs or cleavage. It's not like, hey, baby, look, I'm depressed. You want some of this?
Right.
How does someone tell you?
I think it's a matter of like framing it in terms of like, this is a thing I'm working on. Right. Because again, I guess that's just back to maybe my idiosyncrasy, but, I don't know if I were a, what would be the equivalent for me that's like not depression. So if I'm addicted to, if I'm a smoker, let's say I'm like, hey, so by the way, I'm a smoker, and you're like, I can't deal with a smoker. But if I said, look, I'm struggling to admit this because it's kind of gross these days, but I smoke cigarettes. I would really like to stop. And I would love it if I got into a relationship, if I could find someone who would help me stop and like get better at this. I think that's a much better way to phrase it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've been in relationships where people can be kind of like combative about something that's negative of theirs.
Definitely.
And then they're just like shoving in your face and like, fuck you. Can you handle this? And you're like, whoa, I don't know if I can handle
it. Burnt me with your cigarette.
Yeah. Like let's talk about it from an adult perspective, because I think in LA too, people are so afraid of getting hurt that they may front load like something that's standoffish to keep themselves from getting hurt. Cause then they can be like, well, he couldn't put up with my depression. Well, but yeah, you fucking mentioned it 3 minutes into your first date. Like, in all these things that we're talking about in relationships, it so depends on, like, if you want it to work, you'll figure out a way to phrase it the right way.
I would find a funny way to frame it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you said, if she said it like, you know, I'm working on this and I'd love help getting better, I think that would scare away a lot of people, the help part. Because you seem like an empath. Like, you seem very open to being willing to help, but I think there's so many, not just guys but girls too, a lot of people who would go, oh geez, it's like someone just passed off their laundry to me and I don't even know them that well.
Yeah.
So if you get the sense that someone's like you are, which is empathetic and open-minded and kind and compassionate, you could say, you know, and I would love to be on this path of getting better with someone, you know. You could phrase it like that, but the asking for help part, I think, would scare people away.
Well, do you think that's, I mean, some of that's got to be this town we live in.
Well, definitely. Yeah.
Because I think, like, historically, if you really think, it's taken me a long time to understand this, even about myself, that, like, sometimes the most loving thing you can do is to ask for help, right? To say, like, I need you. I actually need you to help me with this thing.
Yeah.
Which has always been a struggle for me, but I can remember, like, very vividly early in a relationship, where I had like gotten ill during this long date we were on, like fever, and like I could tell like this was going south.
Oh, jeez!
You know? And it was like kind of early, but like we've been spending the night together and stuff. And I remember being like, I would rather you leave because I don't want you to see me.
See, and I would think, oh, he's faking. It's me. It's the perfume and the eyeliner that I drew across my face.
Well, it was pretty clear that I was like sweating and in bad shape.
You weren't making it up, right?
And she's like, oh, really? Because I can like stay and take care of you. And I was like, well, no, I don't want you to have to burden yourself with that, right? And so she left. And then I remember being like, oh, fuck. Like, this is that moment where I should have just said, I need your help. Because I really did. I would have loved to have someone take care of me. I just didn't want to make her feel like Like she had worked
that's your people pleaser part.
Right, right. So I remember calling her on her way to her car, and I was like, look, I screwed up. I would love it if you came back and took care of me. And so she came back, and it was amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because of that lesson of, like, sometimes the best thing you can do for another person is to ask them for help. I love feeling needed, and I'm sure you do, and I'm sure everybody
definitely, yeah,
who's not a sociopath loves feeling like,
which is like maybe 1% of the population,
correct,
at this point.
So I think, like,
I agree, people do want to be needed, and I think we totally forget that. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really good reminder, and I think a lot of the listeners who have depression struggle with talking to people, and that's why they come to a podcast, because mm-hmm. they aren't comfortable enough to go talk to people, and I think they don't know that people are probably really willing to help them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a matter of, like, selecting carefully.
Right. Because there's definitely going to be people that won't.
Right.
But there are going to be people that do feel like it's good to do not a service. And it's not a service. It's not like a charity case type of thing. But it does feel nice. Like today, this is not a great example, but I woke up this morning. My brain is like going a million miles an hour. I don't really know where to start. And so what I do is I just freeze. I kind of get paralyzed and I just lay.
Mm-hmm.
And then my roommate, it was noon. And my roommate was like, is your car on the wrong side of the street? Because it was street parking.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh, shit. And then I was like, I texted her back. And it was nice of her to tell, you know, to remind me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm leaving California. So I don't care. I'll get a ticket. And so we both paused for a second. And then I was like, God damn it. I'll go move it. So when I went out there, the guy parked next to me, his car had stalled out. And, mm-hmm. you know, the first moment where I saw him and I went, oh, geez, I got to help this guy. You know, like,
right,
I got to be a good person. I was just waking up. I was kind of out of it. I was in a little bad mood. I have a million things I need to do, but yet I'm laying. And I'm just like, I got to help this motherfucker. So I got my jumper cables and I helped him, but that made my brain wake up.
Right.
It kickstarted my day in the right. And that was literally, no pun intended, I swear to God. Kickstart, jumpstart, his car. But I was so glad to be of service, even though that first 30 seconds of realizing, like, ah, geez, I got to, you know, get my cables out, I got to pull the car over, and I got to talk to this person.
Yeah.
But then I was like, that felt really, really good, and he was really grateful. And so I'm not saying that a person with depression is the guy stranded with no jumper cables, but
right.
maybe but it could be a metaphor.
Might be you also.
Well, it's definitely me.
But I mean, just like you were not forced to, but you were compelled or felt obligated to help someone.
But it felt nice once
it felt
I did.
Good to you.
And yeah, so yeah. for people with depression, scared to reach out to someone, maybe that person needs to help someone.
Right.
To help themselves in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. So we're going to do some segments right now.
Okay.
And so the first one we're going to do is Who's Sadder?
Okay.
So, who's sadder, nerds or athletes?
Who's sadder, nerds or athletes? Well, nerds are peaking. They're coming off their peak now.
True.
Like one or two years ago was like peak nerd.
Definitely.
Where like every girl was like, oh my God, I'm just a nerd. Mm-hmm. No, you're not.
No, you're not. You're just annoying.
Like I was enough of a nerd, even though I was an athlete, that like when I was 16, one of the best nights of my then life was when Jason Rogers invited three of us dudes to his house.
Who's Jason Rogers?
Just a friend of mine from high school.
Oh. Oh, hey,
not
Jason.
Not a famous person.
Okay.
And we played Doom all night and
Drank nerds.
Mountain Dew. And I remember them being super excited because I had the newest Soundgarden album. That's fucking nerdy.
Are they Black Hole Sun?
Yeah.
Black Hole Sun.
Yeah, is that very
Won't
album.
You yeah. come?
Mm-hmm. So I think nerds are in great shape. Athletes are struggling a little bit. I think nerds are sadder than athletes because present company excluded, most athletes are not thinkers, and it's hard to be sad when you're not a thinker.
So is it true that most athletes aren't thinkers and that's not just a cliche?
It's kind of true. I mean, I think like when you get to the highest levels, everybody's pretty smart, but in the interim, it's pretty dumb.
Is it glory days like with the college athletes and high school athletes, and then they get sad eventually, though? Do you think like that's where I'm going with the question?
I think nerds are sadder is where I'm headed.
You do really?
Yeah.
Is it because they're more aware?
Because you have to be smart enough. Right. To get sad. Even though, like, a lot of the professional basketball players were pretty smart, I have to remember that most athletes are not professional athletes. They're just, like, whatever, high school, college, whatever. And they're just not, sorry, fellow athletes, smart enough to be sad.
Okay, so nerds are sadder.
Yeah.
Okay, next segment. Schizophilia.
Yeah.
I normally would recommend a film, but I was being so good. I was doing research for my podcast, and I put on a movie that I was pretty sure was going to be terrible, but I was giving it the benefit of the doubt. It was terrible. Have you ever heard of the book Brain on Fire?
I have not.
So it's this story of this girl named Savannah Callahan, and it's called Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, and it was a memoir of her experience with encephalitis of the brain. And it, you know, she didn't know what was going on, and she went insane and started seeing things and was acting like schizophrenic and just all over the place and was blacking out and just anyway. So the book was good. Apparently, I haven't read it, but I watched the movie version, which was with Chloe Grace Moretz.
Okay.
She played Savannah, and it was worse than a Lifetime movie. It was so bad, but I was trying so hard to just like watch it. This is research. I have to do it. And I made it about probably 45 minutes in. And then I was like, you know what? Laying and staring would be more entertaining.
Right.
So I just shut it off and just laid.
Ugh.
But
so don't watch that.
Don't watch it.
Bring it on fire.
Maybe check out the book.
Okay.
And it
can't be worse than the movie.
No, but the way they found out that she was experiencing encephalitis was they gave her this test that they give to Alzheimer's and dementia patients where they say to draw a clock.
Okay.
And when they draw the clock, or when she drew the clock, she put all of the numbers on the right-hand side. It didn't go all the way around.
Whoa.
And it showed that that's something that happens when your brain is inflamed.
Okay.
And so her brain was inflamed.
I'm going to remember to give that test to myself next time I think my brain's inflamed.
Yeah. Next time you start.
Draw a clock.
Right. Next time you start screaming in public, draw a clock. And then they'll think you're even crazier because you drew a clock in public. So don't watch that film.
Okay.
But read the book. So the point of that was just to maybe promote the book.
Yeah, that you haven't read.
Because I've read that the book is good. I've not read the book to find out the book is good.
Right.
I've read
heard
that the
about
book
it,
is good.
That it might be good.
Okay, for a depression impression, this is going to air a couple weeks from now, so this will have been, you know, not old news. It's not brand new when you guys are hearing me talk about this right now, but did you hear about this girl named Ellie Sauter? She was a snowboarder. She committed suicide a couple days ago. So it just sounds so bizarre, and you only get the information that's available on the internet. And who knows if it's accurate, but you don't get the insider story. But she was 18 years old, and it was on her 18th birthday. Whoa. And she showed no signs of this happening. She wasn't a depressed girl. Her ex-boyfriend said she would occasionally get down, and they would talk it out, and she would always seem better. But she was found like in a remote area near her home on her 18th birthday, apparently of a suicide. Whoa. And she was this up-and-coming potential, like, Olympian athlete. And it just is, like, bizarre.
Yeah.
One of those things. They didn't have the method or anything. And it said her death has technically not been ruled by the coroner yet, but it points to suicide.
Right, right.
It's just crazy. How does that happen? To myself, I think there's got to be, like, someone murdered her. But, you know, this stuff can happen out of the blue, I guess. It just seems so crazy.
Especially if you are that good at your thing.
They said the one thing she felt pressured by was raising money to compete or raise money for something snowboarding. And I don't know if she felt, I don't know if her financial situation like was terrible and felt like there was no way out and her dad was poor or something. I don't know, but she was incredibly close with her father and they were raising money.
I think it is, it just reminds us that everyone is going through something, right? I remember when the lead singer of Linkin Park killed himself.
Oh, yeah.
The reason that I bring that up is that a lot of people had said about Linkin Park, like, oh, they're like posers and they're like they're doing fine. They're just kind of making up this angst. You're like, I don't know. They seem pretty angsty. Like, that seems legit.
Right.
And then the guy, like, kills himself. And you're like, oh, yeah, he was serious. Like, he was not happy.
That was, right? He was not a poser.
And so I think what we forget and is difficult in this day and age especially is that just because you have money or means or resources doesn't mean that you're immune to feeling shitty.
Right.
Right? Like, right. I think that's the like, usual critique is, like, well, what could some, like, this was always the critique of, like, grunge and nu metal and all that. Like, what could these, like, suburban kids be so angsty about? Like, I don't fucking know. Why is anybody angsty? You just are. Right. It's just how it is.
Right.
And in fact, like, I've been reading the Sebastian Younger book, Tribe. And it's the main thesis is basically that, like, tribal communities were and are happier because they had something to unite against. But there's very low suicide rates in tribal communities because you're, like, closer. There's actually lower suicide rates amongst poorer people than middle class. Like, you have to get pretty wealthy before you start thinking about killing yourself.
Right.
In the same way that, like, you have to be pretty smart to be depressed.
Right.
So I think, like, in a weird way, you're actually, it's more likely that you're going to be the snowboarder girl or, you know, Chester Bennington, and she's 18, so the hormones, like, that's I think the
teenage thing. It's like, you can't, I would love to just drill a hole through a child's head, mm-hmm. as long as it didn't kill them, and insert the information with, like, a microchip thing that says, this will pass, you will not always be this teenager, what you're thinking is a big deal now will not be a big deal. Don't kill your parents because they don't want you to date this boy. It's insignificant, even though you think it feels huge. I just want to give them that information.
Right.
And when a teenager commits suicide, it's so frustrating because they didn't get to that point to realize that it was a phase or they were going to get through it or whatever.
Yeah.
They cut off that chance.
Yeah. I think sometimes when I get anxious in the sense of, like, nervous for an encounter or something, it will occasionally hit me, like, oh shit, I used to feel like that when I was 16 all the time, like, all day long. And now I just sort of take for granted that, like, I might be worried about something or, like, slightly anxious about something. But generally speaking, I can kind of, like, return myself to a centering. You're also not talking about how you feel ever. And nobody's ever.
I was. I don't know. I oh, really? Whenever I see kids that, like, didn't want to tell their parents things, I don't understand because I was like, mom, this, mom, I'll tell you this. This happened, mommy, mom, I'll tell you more. Like, I was not that teenager, but I obviously many of them are.
Right. I think amongst, like, teenage boys too, you're definitely not encouraged to talk about, like, I'm anxious, guys.
Right.
What the fuck's wrong
And
with
I forget
you?
About that a lot. Being a girl, I forget culturally when you're a boy and you're sad and you can't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Whereas a girl, you're encouraged.
Yeah. So we go play basketball. And
right. Anyway, so... Your podcast, the dates I tell, or the stories I tell on dates, the dates I tell on the stories. That's the sequel.
Uh-huh.
Stories I Tell on Dates is available on iTunes and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, listen for free on iTunes podcasts.
And you can also get the book on Amazon, though, if you want.
If you want to, like, slog through an actual reading experience.
There are people that do that. It's so weird.
It's wild.
Wild and crazy stuff. Well, check out Paul's podcast and his book, and also follow him on Twitter. Is it at Paul Shirley?
It's at Paul Then Shirley.
Then?
Yeah.
T-H-E-N?
A joke on how my last name is a girl's name.
Oh, that's cute.
People call me by my first name.
Right. Oh, yeah. Ugh. So you're Shirley.
Right.
Oh, that's cute. I like that. So Paul Then Shirley on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you to everyone who's been listening and who's been supporting the show and so wonderful about supporting the show. If you want to continue supporting the show, you can do so by leaving me a good iTunes review or just a good rating, and come to the Patreon page, patreon.com/mentallychill, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, you guys know the deal. Stay sad enough to listen, but not too sad. Bye, guys.